All right. Welcome, everyone, to another Sunday afternoon here on Revolution Radio. I am Stephen Roberts, and this is Councilor Cabal. First, I want to repeat what Tom said just before he went off air. We are listener-supported, so if you like what we're doing here, please go hit that donate button. But today I have actually two guests on the first hour. I am going to welcome the founder and executive director of Well House. I want to get a little bit of a bio here. The Well House, immediate shelter and transitional living facility for women victims of sexual exploitation and human trafficking. Well House is an agency that provides immediate shelter to women who have been sexually exploited, including women who have been trafficked. The Well House offers shelter, food, clothing, spiritual guidance, and other necessary items to support exploited women. Well House also offers life skill classes, GED preparation, and other services as deemed necessary. I want to welcome Tawan McCarty to the show. Welcome, Tawan.
Hi, thank you. It's an honor and pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you very much.
Just so you know, we have grown so much over the past few years that I stepped down as executive director in August of last year, and Carolyn Potter is our current executive director. I just continue to do the speaking and public awareness and trainings for law enforcement and administrate our agency because we've grown so much. The ministry is very much needed, so we're just grateful to God for the exponential growth.
Oh, yes, absolutely. What prompted you to actually found this organization, Tawan?
Well, I wanted to help the women that were like me. I knew that we were doing street outreach at the Birmingham Dream Center. Lisa Roxanne Richardson and I, and I knew that there would come a day that there would be a girl we couldn't help, and it happened on July the 2nd of 2010, and so July the 3rd, I actually began developing our ministry and just wanting to have a ministry with a place where no requirements, where she didn't have to have ID, you know, 24/7. Our crisis line is 24/7, so she can call in at any time. Didn't have to be clean off drugs like some treatment centers want her to, you know, want you to, or just something different and a little bit outside the box. And didn't even realize my own victimization until opening Well House, because we perpetuate blaming women for their problems and things that are happening in their life. And so, you know, when God gave me the vision, we just began. And we're a place of grace where no one's turned away.
That's absolutely great. Do you actually want to talk about your own victimization, or would you rather not?
Oh, we can, sure. I began running away when I was 12, between 12 and 15. I ran away more times than I could count. I was blamed for the first time my sexual abuse began at 12. I was raped by some people that I knew, some guys I knew, and my social worker asked me, when's the last time you had sex? And, you know, being older now, I'm 44, I realized that at 12 years old, I couldn't have consented. But also at 12, when that happened, it, you know, placed a blame factor on me, so it was my fault. At 15, I ran away for the last time, and I met my first pimp. I thought he loved me more than he did the other girls, because at first he had me selling drugs, and the whole time he's telling me, don't do it, don't ever do it. He was talking about using the drugs, and when we all had to make quota, we had family meetings, and when you didn't make your quota, your punishment happened in public, in front of everyone. It didn't happen in a private room, so you always knew what would happen if you didn't. And one particular night, he sends me out to sell drugs, but there's not enough drugs to make quota, and so the tables had turned. Did I physically submit to selling myself at 15? Yes, I did. It was still rape. It wasn't something I wanted, and still wasn't of age to consent to anything. And he told me some truth. He told me I would be arrested, and he would not. And at 16, I was arrested for the first time for prostitution and booked into the jail and raped by the officer who took me to the mattress room. So there was no one I could trust. There was no one to turn to. And so physically I could have left, but psychologically I could not have. And because I had ran away, it was my fault. I was blamed. And I've actually, I'm not from Birmingham originally. That's where I live now, but I was brought here so much, it became home. You know, I've been sold in every state, Alaska and Hawaii, and I've been sold in Canada and Mexico. This is a national and international problem, but it's in our backyard across the United States.
And you're referring to trafficking, aren't you?
I am. And these are my sisters. These are our daughters. These are not foreign nationals. And I'm not saying that doesn't happen here, but I've only rescued, assisted one foreign national since opening Well House, and we've rescued over 200.
Well, that's good. That's good. Why were you sold in so many states?
Because we perpetuated in our society, and we supported, and it's okay to purchase sex. 95% of the purchasers of sex are men, 5% are female. And we think it's okay that she's doing it because she wants to. It's her choice. And one of the things I've realized is none of it ever starts as an adult. None of it. None of the women we have helped, or the children we have helped, does it ever start as an adult and consensual. Even if she says she wants to, she's in denial. And no one wants to grow up to do this, and it's rape. It's consistent rape, but we support it. In the United States, we sexualize everything. Everything. And so, we think if she's working in a strip club, she's there by choice, or if she's, in a porn film, she's there by choice, and she's not. The first time I was put on a stage at a strip club, I was 15. And even when my pimp wasn't there, the bouncer wouldn't let me leave. So it's a problem.
Yes, it is. Were you actually sold by the same man? Or was it, I guess I'm asking, were you sold to other pimps?
Oh, yes. I was bought, sold, and traded. I was actually given away one time.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, that's normal.
Yeah. How long did all of this, when did you actually say enough was enough?
I was arrested in 1997 here in Birmingham, and got out. I didn't call my pimp that time, and was able to stay out. And the old American way, I picked myself up by my bootstraps, dusted myself off, and obtained a bachelor's degree and began working on two master degrees. In the middle of two master degrees, I relapsed on drugs because I did start using those drugs very shortly, probably within 48 hours of selling myself the first time at 15. And it does become a vicious, ugly cycle, but drugs are not the problem. It's a coping mechanism in order to emotionally deal with the rapes that are happening daily. And I relapsed on those drugs in the middle of two master degrees, was re-exploited in 2006 and 2007. Went back to prison because I was in prison the first time when I was 19. Went back to prison in 2008 and got out in 2009. That's when I met Lisa and met Christ. She introduced me to Jesus, and not the Jesus I thought I had learned about young, you know, the hellfire and brimstone Jesus, but the true love of Christ, and my life changed. My life changed. And shortly after receiving Christ is when that was at the end of 2009. And it was July 2010 that God gave me the vision for Well House. So it didn't take long at all for him to call me to do something.
That is a great story. I'm assuming that that your own life experiences, Tuan, is the reason why you started Well House then?
Oh, absolutely. Because drug treatment centers, they want you to be clean to come in when you come in, or if you use while you're there, they'll put you out. That didn't make sense to me. Homeless shelters are full. They want you to have ID, or you have to be there by a certain time. So there's not like 24-hour rescue or services there. Domestic violence shelters don't want to take women victims of trafficking or sexual exploitation because the trauma is different, and it's not necessarily a domestic situation based on their definition. And so it needed to be something different and something a little bit outside the box. And so there's a few questions we ask when we get a crisis call on our crisis line. And, if she answers yes, then she's accepted. I'm sure there's a handful of women that I've never known their real name, and it doesn't matter. There was one woman I talked to on the phone for over 6 months before I actually met her. She was so afraid to meet with me. Finally met her, and she came in a few months later. But the horror, and the trauma is so deep that, a lot of places don't know how to deal with our trauma or how to help us. You know, we've had counselors turn away our girls as they were seeking help in other areas and saying, I don't know what to do. We've had counselors call Well House seeking our help because they've run across a trafficking victim and don't know how to deal with the trauma. So it's not easy work. It's not easy work.
No, I'm sorry. No, I can imagine it isn't. Tawan, do you think a counselor is almost needs a prerequisite for some type of abuse to actually empathize with a lot of women? Or are you there, Tawan?
I'm here. Something happened during that. It kind of blanked out on me.
Oh, okay. Well, might have had a little Skype glitch there. I have them quite often. Do you think your counselors need to have some sort of a prerequisite of their own abuse to be an effective counselor?
Absolutely not. One of the best counselors I've ever met, hasn't experienced the kind of abuse that I have. But she's trauma specific. You know, as long as counselors are trained in trauma and understanding the depths of the trauma and, that, you know, at Well House, our primary goal is to lead our ladies to Christ, because that's where healing takes place. You know, I've tried everything. I did self-help. I did, you know, the do-it-yourself programs. If you do this, this, and this, you'll get better. And none of it worked, until I met Christ and actually started walking through it. So it's not necessarily having to have the same experience, but just understanding the depths and dynamics of the horror stories that is, you know, when I train people that are frontline workers across the nation, I let them know that those horror stories you hear that sound like, oh my gosh, that's from a TV movie, and you may not want to believe it. It's usually the truth because you just can't make up that kind of stuff, and they need to be believed.
Oh, yes.
And so as long as, you know, you're willing to walk through the depths with her, I think that's the most important part when it comes to being counselor.
Why do you think men are the worst abusers? Have you ever studied the psychology behind the abuse?
Well, you know, the demographic for the purchaser of sex currently, the Department of Justice or the Office of Victims of Crime recently put out, I can't remember which one it is 18 to 60 year old Caucasian men with expendable income. And so that's the power elite of our society. And we, think it's okay. You know, we've got this old adage, you know, in the South, definitely, boys will be bullies. And that's not okay. You know, if you get more sexual partners as a male, you're, you know, a stud. But a female, you're a whore, and so she's blamed. And we've got to change that concept. It's not okay. It's not okay to watch pornography. That's rape also. Whether it's a screen on your phone or computer, we don't know what's going on behind that camera. And, you know, the adult entertainment, the strip club, she's not working her way through college. She doesn't want to be there. That's not the truth. And you don't know what goes on behind the scenes, and we've got to stop perpetuating the over-sexualization of everything in our society. I mean, there are commercials on TV now that, I don't watch TV much, but I've heard about that, you know, it's a national chain trying to sell food that is sexualizing everything. And it doesn't make sense to me. We've got to change that. You know, we're all treasures. We're not trophies. And I think that's the biggest misconception we have especially in America, that a woman's supposed to be a trophy and she's not treated as the treasure she is, or a girl, for that matter.
Oh, I totally agree. I totally agree. I see a lot of advertising come up on, well, people tell me a lot of advertising to come up on web pages, and there might be this little dating site or whatever, and the advertisement, and you can click on it, and I have clicked on them, and they go to go to webcams.
Yeah. You know, the chair of our board, I dearly love him. When he first got involved, you know, we had many conversations because he couldn't understand, you know, how it was happening. And, you know, we had deep conversations about, you know, him being the demographic because he fits into that with, you know, the 18 to 60 year old Caucasian males that I was just talking about. And he happened to go to our Facebook page for Well Health. And he called me. He was like, why am I seeing ads on our Facebook page that are like dating sites or, you know, wanting me to click here or click there about, he said, it's sexualization on our Facebook page. Why is that happening? And I explained to him that even the ads on there that you can purchase, you can select the demographic you want it to touch. So if you go in and you say, okay, I want, like, say if I were to want do one for Well House, I would probably want to touch males and females, 10 to 80, but you can select all the criteria. And so when I go to the Facebook page and see that, or see ads, I don't see the same ads that you might or he did. And that's what I had to explain to him. I said, that's not geared at Well House. That's geared toward you and the demographic you are.
That's actually a Facebook algorithm. A lot of the times it really has nothing to do with the Facebook group at all.
Yeah, nothing at all. It's just got to do with your basic demographics. If you put in your birthday, your race, your income, which are some of the things that they ask you when you're, and some of that you don't have to answer, but some stuff you have to answer. And so you can target a specific group. And, if you and I both were to log in to different sites, because of our demographics, we would get something different as far as advertising.
Oh, yeah.
And we've got to be more aware of that.
Actually, Tuan, three people can be logged in on in the exact same room on three computers, and they can put in a Google search, and they'll get three different results to come up.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's sad because, people ask me, how are we going to fight this? What are we going to do? What is the basic fight of trafficking? And there's a couple of things that I truly believe. Number one is we have to start talking to our children about sex, and we have to have those hard conversations that we don't want to have. That's number one. Number two is that we've got to treat girls and women as treasures. We've got to get rid of the concept and the thought that boys will be boys.
Oh, yes, yes. I think a lot of what you're discussing, Tuan, changed probably a little more than 100 years ago. In America, anyways, it changed around the world. A lot more time than, the last 110 to 115 years. But things really changed in America around the turn of the 20th century. And they changed for the worse.
Yes. And the fight against trafficking is very, very similar to the domestic violence battle 35 years ago. That battle was she married him, or, she's choosing to be with him, why don't she just leave? And it's not that simple. With Stockholm Syndrome and PTSD and having nowhere to go, it's really difficult to leave. A domestic violence victim, it usually takes her about 7 times of leaving and going back before she actually fully escapes. And from what I've seen with women who have been sexually exploited or in traffic, it takes about 11 times of going in and out. And if we don't show love and grace through all that, we're really missing the point.
Yeah. A few days ago, Tuan, we talked on the phone, and we talked about a movie that is out there, and I believe that they have actually two sequels to it right now. The movie called Taken. I know that a lot of people believe around the world that that actually happens, and for some extent, not all as much as a lot of people think, but it does actually happen. In the movie there, the main character's daughter was, I believe, 18 years of age, or 17, that's what she was, and she was taken by some criminal group.
Yes. That movie is probably about, it represents probably about 2 to 5% of how it actually happened. There are some reform pimps that have come out, and one of them made a statement that just blew me away, but it's actual truth. He said, I could go into any middle or high school event, and within 5 minutes tell you, I could point out at least five, maybe 10 girls that would leave with me willingly. So it's not necessarily the kidnapping, it's the fact that we all have insecurities, and our basic human desire is love and belonging. And so once you learn how to feed on those insecurities, it's easy to talk someone into something, especially a young girl that's, naive or a runaway, because that's even more dynamic. There's so many situations. It's not a socioeconomic problem. It's not necessarily a runaway problem. It's a problem that that advertising you and I were just talking about perpetuates, is the over-dramatization of girls.
Yeah, yeah.
And sexualizing them.
Yeah. It's not so much girls, it is boys too. I do know psychologically, Tawan, that children want to please the adult figure, whether it's a their mother or father or some type of a someone in their family or even a authority figure in their local community. The adult is seen as that caring authoritative figure, and just so many times it's not true.
Right. I mean, even, you know, abused children even defend their parents. That's normal. And that's part of the Stockholm Syndrome that I was talking about. It's very normal to love the person who's hurting you and to take up for them.
Oh, it certainly is. It certainly is. And we also spoke the other day on the phone about, well, people like Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy. They did not actually abduct anyone. All of their victims went with them willingly. I also believe that the Jeffrey Dahmer, the one up there in Milwaukee, all of his victims entered his house willingly.
Yes. Yes, and it's very sad, and you know that's why at the Well House we're just trying to do something different and you know, provide a way out. Whether it's whatever she needs immediately, you know, whether we have to work with her for some time to build the trust, or it's a crisis situation and she is getting out now, it's just imperative that we offer those services.
How do you help women with the many, many months, or actually probably years, of emotional and physical and mental abuse?
Well, we have some different concepts that other agencies or other ministries and nonprofits don't have. And number one is we're, like I said earlier, we're a place of grace. We don't care if she kind of goes in and out. Matter of fact, our shelter is, I consider it, a revolving door. But when she comes in, she's never charged a dime the entire time she's with us. We provide everything she needs, including all her basic physical needs. When a lady comes in the door, she gets everything she would needs immediately: shampoo, conditioner, all her hygiene products, clothes, brand new bras, brand new panties. We have a social worker that assesses her within 24 hours to determine if there are any medical needs that she has that are immediate, and we make sure we address those. And we also assess if she has any mental health needs. We even pay for prescription medication if she needs it, you know, any antibiotics or anything that she were to need. Which is really different, you know, most places don't do that. But we want to make sure that there's never a lack or a want for anything. And that doesn't just include the first 24 or 48 hours. That includes the entire time she's with us. We have a little piece of paper that's, you know, said, I need this. And whether, you know, she's out of deodorant, she needs some more deodorant, then we'll go to our, we have some storage areas that we keep all of our stuff in that people donate, and, you know, make sure she has it. They're always, and, you know, we are humans and we all need stuff, and we just make sure that she has always provided everything she needs. Our long-term program is a little more in-depth. It's actually an application process and a commitment from her. But it's saying that I want to get better, and so we do a lot of life skills. She gets individual and group counseling, discipleship, Bible studies, GED preparation. We've got four of our ladies right now that are about to start a local community college. One just finished getting her licensure for an LPN. Our recent graduate started her own business. But we provide all that stuff. I had a gentleman when I was at a speaking engagement the other day. He said, well, who paid for all the applications and everything for college? And I was like, we did. Because, you know, that's not stuff that you can get a grant for. You have to actually pay that out of pocket. And he said, well, who pays for the GED? And I'm like, we do. Because, you know, there's an application fee to take a GED or to get a high school diploma. And we provide tutors if she needs it. We have volunteers that are willing to tutor. So we really individually assess each person, each woman that she comes in, and try to meet those needs, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual.
Speaking of GEDs and education, I also understand that you're an adjunct professor down there in Birmingham.
I have been, yes. I haven't been in probably about two semesters now, but I do adjunct professor at UAB in the Department of Social Work. I love teaching. That is one of my gifts. And I usually do intro to social work or social welfare policy analysis. I'm a policy nerd and really enjoy engaging students and understanding policy and actually getting excited about it. So, yeah, I really enjoy that. And we do take a lot of interns ourselves at Well House, you know, to help them understand what the workforce is going to look like before they graduate.
What does it actually mean to be an adjunct professor, Tuan?
It means that I usually teach one class a semester. For two semesters, I was actually assisting the program director in supervising the social work interns that were placed at agencies that didn't have a social worker. My bachelor's is in social work. One of my master degrees is in public health, and my other master's in public administration. So based on education and what you're trying to do, you have to have oversight. So I've really helped the Department of Social Work there doing that. But it just means that it's a contract professorship is what it is. So.
Oh, okay. I see. Well, that's pretty, that's very, very good. I'm trying to search here. What kind of direction can we go? I know we talked on the other phone about, trafficking outside of America. Can we go into that some?
We don't really, I haven't done a lot of research on outside of America. My primary focus is on America because we do have the problem here. Overseas, from what I know, and from people that have gone on mission trips and just a little bit of research I've done, it's much more public than it is in America, because we tend to live in the United States with blinders on, and overseas a lot of times it's culturally acceptable, and so it tends to be much more open than it is here, and starts much younger. I mean, I've actually held a pair of shoes that were found outside of a brothel that was raided, I think it was in Thailand, and the shoes didn't even fit, they weren't big enough to cover my hand. It broke my heart. So, we have the international problem. One of the things I focus on when I do look at international trafficking is how it affects the United States, because we don't necessarily understand that cocoa, where coffee and chocolate come from, has a huge labor trafficking problem, not just sex trafficking, when it comes to children. And so a lot of times, as consumers in the U.S., we don't necessarily know how many slaves we actually have working for us. And that's sad. There's I think it's Slavery Footprint is the name of it, that you can actually go in and take this little survey, and it will tell you how many slaves you have working for you, based on your home and some other demographics that they ask you about, you know, your clothes, what you eat, what you drink, and looking at that supply chain.
Are you talking about your own personal business or somebody's personal business?
Actually, not necessarily personal business, but you're as a consumer in the United States. You have to look at a lot of stuff is brought in from overseas, and so, you know, it's not made in America, and there's, you know, a huge problem when it comes to that supply chain and how people are used overseas as labor trafficking victims.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'm not mistaken, it's Slavery Footprint. You can literally go in and take a survey, and it will tell you how many slaves that you have working for you based on the way you live in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty, that's
sad,
well,
isn't it?
Yes, well, it is sad. I know a lot of the times China is, they're blamed for for being one of the biggest perpetrators of, not so much sex slavery, but, being a work slave.
Right. I mean, we have a global problem when it comes to trafficking. You know, human trafficking is sex trafficking and it's labor trafficking. And right now, the numbers that the Department of Justice and the United Nations, they're saying about 27 million people worldwide are enslaved. That's a lot of people. And we've got to start doing something about it. We've got to change that. It's not okay.
No, not at all. Not even close to being okay. How do the people of the world need to be educated, Twan? Do you think it's spiritually, religiously, or some other type of way?
Well, of course, I'm a Christian, and so I do believe that we have to educate across the board when it comes to our churches, regardless of what religion you are. And we've got to stand together, united, and say that this is not happening anymore. And I'm not going to continue to support this. If we don't stand together and say this is not okay and fight against it, then we're going to need more well houses. We're going to need more beds. Right now, there's only about 300 beds in the United States that are specific for women victims of trafficking, and it's just not enough. So, I mean, the church has got to stand up. The government's got to do something. Men have got to stand up, and not just the women in this fight, and tell their brothers it's not okay to watch pornography. It's not okay to go to a strip club. It's not okay to purchase a girl or a woman for sex. And it's rape. And we can't continue to allow it to happen.
No, I believe you're right. I did happen to mention spiritually a minute ago. You don't really have to be religious to have good morals.
No.
No, you don't. No, I think there are a lot of non-religious people that are actually very, very good people morally.
Oh, absolutely. And we've got to, say it's not okay. Right now, in the United States, adult entertainment, whether it's a strip club or pornography, is legal. That's not okay. I think the last number I heard was a $15 billion industry in the United States alone. That's a lot of money. We have got to turn that money around and start using it to help the ones we've already hurt, and then prevent kids, boys and girls, from being exploited now and in the future. We've got to start having the hard conversations with people. You know, it's sad that when you go on, there's a online Christian magazine that I looked at that said 56% of the pastors in the South admit to having a problem with pornography. 56%, that's the ones that admit it.
Yeah, that's a pretty good number. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a big number, and they just poll pastors. You know, what about the people sitting in the pews or the man on the job or... it's not okay. She is a treasure and not a trophy, and it's not willing. You're not a little girl going, excuse me, I want to grow up and be prostituted.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's not a goal in life. And for the ones who have already been exploited, we've got to stop treating her as a criminal and look at her as the victim she is. Just because she turned 18, this is one of the things I ask when I speak is, I'm trying to meet the person that had an epiphany on their 18th birthday. That all of a sudden you're financially stable and emotionally secure and spiritually mature. And that didn't happen just because you turned 18. So why are we criminalizing her at 18 and not looking at her as the victim she is? Just because she's now, quote unquote, an adult.
Well, I happen to mention that, the sexualization of people started changing around the turn of the 20th century, but it really got horrible in the, I believe, the late 40s when Dr. Kinsey, I think his name was Alfred Kinsey, come out with his two books, and the names of his books escape me. Do you know who I'm talking about?
I don't. I was actually trying to figure out how to recall. I'm not familiar with his work. What were the books about?
Dr. Alfred Kinsey both of his books basically boil down the sexualization of the girl or the woman and the man, the humans. He has been accredited to being the grandfather of the sexual revolution of the 60s with his two books and his so-called, quote, studies of the sexual, of the human sexualization ended up being what he characterized as science, but what you and I would characterize as pedophilia. He studied children, basically, from the age of 3 and 4 months up until the age of 18, and he their subjects were molested, and he was heralded as a a god, just about, like, to the progressive movement. Anyways,
I was actually looking him up as I was listening to you. He was considered a sexologist.
Yes, sexologist. And his subjects ranged anywhere from, like I said, from the age of 3 to 4 months up until the age of 18. We would call that pedophilia today, or child molestation. And his actual, people that he studied, the predominantly men, were sex offenders.
Wow. I'm actually going to have to read up on him now. Yeah, that doesn't...
You need to, when you get a chance, maybe you can do a YouTube search on Dr. Judith Reisman. She studied him for the last 40 plus years, and she's written some books, and she's got a lot of interviews out there. I actually had her on one time for about 45 minutes. She's quite elderly. She's in her mid-70s and that, probably even closer to 80, but... she's actually written some books on Dr. Alfred Kinsey, and she studied him for a long time, and pretty much exposed him as the as a pedophile.
Oh wow! Yeah, we've got to, we've got to make some dynamic thinking changes and social changes. And this is where people get bogged down, is that they can't think they don't think one person can make a difference, and you actually can. You know, for those who are listening, and have just now learning about trafficking and what we're, how we're perpetuating in our society. If you go tell five people, and then ask those five people to tell five people, you touch 25 immediately, and ask those to tell five more, and we can make a social change. We can spread the love of Christ.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Absolutely can. What would you like how would you like to see, would you like to see just a actual religious revelation come across the? I know I would, not so much religious, but a spiritual revelation come across the world.
Oh, absolutely. And just like you were talking, not just spiritual, but to understand that we're all made in God's image. We're not to be mistreated. The abuse and the sexualization of boys and girls and women and men, it's got to stop. We've got to make some dynamic spiritual and social changes. And we've got to stand up and say, I'm not going to watch this. I'm not going to have this in my home. I don't want this anymore. It's not okay. And to continue to talk to people, because she's being raped and we're blaming her. Or he's being raped and we're blaming him. It very much reminds me of, if you hadn't worn that short skirt, or if you hadn't gone to that club, or if you hadn't done this, then it wouldn't have happened to you. That's blaming. We can't continue to do that, and we've got to say that abuse is no longer acceptable.
It is. It is. and that's a little bit odd, but my second guest after you leave me here this hour, Tuan, is a woman. She's actually down somewhere, I think in North Carolina right now, but, she's coming on next. She has a case, kind of pending. Doesn't really have a case because the prosecutor doesn't want to prosecute a man that raped her, just on, circumstances, just because of that. I don't know whether it was the way she looked, or actually we're probably going to get into it after I leave you, but you know, it's just the prosecutor doesn't want to go after the case.
Yeah, that's sad. That's system failure. You know, I remember a judge telling me at 14 years old, I was running away, and, you know, healthy children from healthy homes don't run away. And this judge looked at me and told me I was incorrigible. And I asked him, what does that mean? And a judge at 14 said, there is no hope for you.
Yeah.
You know, it's system failure. We can't continue to look at the behavior. We've got to look at the basic problem. And the basic problem is, again, going back to what I said earlier, is we all want to feel love and belonging. And we've got to view each other as God image bearers of God. It's because if we don't, then we're going to continue to hurt others. And it's not okay. That breaks my heart for her.
No, it's not. Not even close to being okay. I think it really starts with the family. It starts with men and women. It doesn't so much start with children, because children are going to emulate whatever they grow up with or whatever they're used to. So I think men and women need to be worked on the most.
Absolutely. You know, we've got to stop the generational abuse. We've got to stop wanting her to be a size 2. I actually was reading something the other day. An economist did a study just on the United States, and that if women in the United States would stop buying beauty products for 1 week, we would have an economic downfall. There would be like another depression in the United States.
Not surprising at all. Well, I've heard that women don't really pretty themselves up or dress up for men anymore. It's more or less dressing up for other women.
Yeah, I was having a conversation similar to that with our friend the other day, at how we as women hurt each other, and, you know, judge, and we compare ourselves to other women.
Yeah, yeah.
And but part of that is, you know, what we've been saying this whole hour is that's what we're accepting socially, you know, and it's sad. It just breaks my heart.
It is. It is. I've been lambasted on social media a few times for some of my views. I know it seems a little bit silly, but I've put the phrase out there that if the cosmetic industry went away tomorrow, it would take most of the male population about a half a second to get over it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Women would not, but yeah, male would, yeah, they would
not. Yeah. I know. Well, there are a lot of men out there that are starting to, I don't know if you want to say feminize themselves, but, you know, and that's really sad too, because there's a actual line of male cosmetics out there. Quite a few lines, the way I understand.
Yeah. I don't know. We've just got to make some changes in the way we think and in our perception in society, and stop sexualizing everything.
Be
examples of good, of godly men and women to our kids, to others, and, you know, stop exploiting her.
Yeah.
It
all seems to be about the image, and it has been about the image for about the last 100 plus years now. The elite control structure has actually changed society in that way of thinking. You know what, Tawan? The people that are in control and the people that have all of this industries that people like you are fighting against, and me myself, they don't really care about money anymore, Tawan. But they do care that you and I care about money, or not just you and I physically, but metaphorically.
Right.
The people of the world need to care a little bit less about money and care more about about ourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, because that's the root of what we're dealing with and the fight I'm in. You know, it's we're looking at people as commodities and not people. You know, we see them, if you now take a drug dealer, and they can only sell the drugs one time. But a person, you can sell them over and over and over again.
Yes, yes, you can. I see it go around social media a lot, Tawan, about you know, the size of the woman really shouldn't matter, and I think it, you know, you don't really, but you happened to mention it just a little while ago. You don't really have to be a size 2 to be appealing to someone, and I've always gone along with that myself. And the people that are thin seem to get defensive about pushing themselves on other people.
Absolutely. You know, I've been small and I've been large, and I'm neither now. I'm kind of in between, but I'm healthier than I've ever been in life as far as spiritually, emotionally, and that's the key. You know, I truly believe that's the key, is accepting who we are and whose we are, and that we are images of God. And just continuing to see others as valuable and worthy and not a commodity.
Absolutely. How do you get major funding? Or how do you get funding for the Well House?
We're a public charity. We do get some foundational grants, and we're having a big fundraiser, or we're having a zoo event that's been a big fundraiser for us. And we've got some great local businesses that have come in as sponsors for that event. That'll be next Sunday. Other than that, it's people who want to donate. On our website, it's the-wellhouse.org. There's a donate button, but literally it's public funding. It's people that want to give for us to be able to help. And we've rescued from Washington State to Miami, Florida. When God gave me the vision, it was originally, I wanted to clean up Birmingham because I knew there's enough girls here that needed help. And the first rescue was actually out of Florida. But, you know, because of the low number of beds and because of the way we're just different and not charging, or, you know, and making sure she has everything she needs while she's with us, people have honored that and come alongside us and to help. Right now we've got about, we're averaging about 20 women between our shelter and our Next Steps to Freedom. Our youngest is 18, and our oldest right now is 56. So we have a gamut of ages and needs, and we need all the help we can get.
Yes, yes. That's obvious to see. There's a big problem out there in the world with trafficking and just sexual abuse in general.
Absolutely. If we had the money that the trafficking industry made and put it into victim services and prevention, we could change the world.
Yeah, you wouldn't even need that kind of money, really. You could probably, you could probably get away with, I don't know, 1/5 of the money that is in the sex trafficking world,
and absolutely, still
have a profound effect on thousands and tens of thousands of lives.
Absolutely. When God gave me the vision, I didn't realize how many we would help. My goal is, I truly believe what Jesus says, you leave the 99 for the one. When it was me by myself doing everything that we do at Well House, I was at a speaking engagement. I had about 200 people, and the crisis line came to my cell phone at that time. And I told them, I said, if I get a crisis call, because it shows up different the way I programmed it, it showed up different on my phone. I said, if I get a call, I'm going to take it. I don't care if I'm standing in front of you speaking or not, and because her life is more important than y'all. Y'all are safe. And if the crisis calls come in, she's not. And there was one engagement, I literally left because of a crisis call. And I had to go get a girl.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. Do you do a lot of speaking engagements around the country, or just around your area?
I do a lot in the Southeast. I'll be in Illinois, at a women's conference next weekend. All over the East Coast. We've got to raise awareness. I do a lot of law enforcement training, from local to state to federal, partner with some great law enforcement agencies and helping them see signs, Last week, I trained EMTs and nurses and social workers in Northeast Alabama so they could get some CEUs and other credits they needed, but also so they could find out what the signs and all are and how to spot a victim and how to help when they do come across them, you know, frontline workers. And I do speak at a lot of churches. So it's kind of wherever I'm called is where I go to speak. And some of it's giving testimony as what, you know, God has done in my life. And so that people understand the dynamics of the victimization and the trauma that we do suffer. But sometimes it's just training for the frontline workers or attorneys or whoever it may be that needs to know.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we've only got about, I think, about 3 minutes till we until the hour and until the break, Twan. Would you like to take a few minutes here and say some words?
Absolutely. You know, this is one of the things that I want everyone to take away is that it's not a choice just because someone's an adult. And she's a princess. She's a child of God. She is a daughter of the King. And we have got to reach our hand down into the darkness and show her the light. We have got to love her exactly where she is and meet her exactly where she is in order to help her more. And on top of that, we've got to stop looking at people as commodities and trophies. We have to start looking at each other as treasures and God image bearers. If we don't do that, then I think we're going to continue to fail our children, our everyone. We're going to just continue to fail, period, if we don't see people as treasures, you know.
Yes, yes, I do. I think it's actually going to take a lot more than what you're referring to, Tuan. I think it's actually people are going to have to look at their own lives and look at their own souls, and they're going to have to ask themselves what they want in life. If they want a better life, they're going to have to do better things. They're going to have to be kinder to people. They are going to have, well, they're going to, they might have to sacrifice. They might have to make less money to create that vision. People might have to go back to a one income family type of system. Have less of these little, you know, flashy amenities that Americans and people of the world have. Do a little bit more with having less.
Absolutely. And you're right. We're just going to take some internal examination of each of us, for each of us, and what we're doing and how we perpetuate the problem.
There are solutions out there to every single problem that the world has. People just have to be able to look outside their little box and look outside their little paradigm. Well, I'd like to finish that thought off, but I thank you for coming on, Twan McCarty. And we will be right back after the break, everyone.